The universe begins not in light, as we have been taught, but in song. A string, 10 billion, 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 billionths of a meter in length, turned upon itself as a cosmic loop, struck to sound an annunciation, a birth colored, strange, and charming. This universe, small and tight, reabsorbs its energies, passing them back and forth, emptying and refilling the same endless sea. This universe, as it expands, becomes different. First, gravity weighed down drops away, then the forces which bind the atomic nucleus together, then those which carry charge within the atom, then between atoms. In this universe, charges come in discrete quantities. 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, flowing back and forth between the crowded parts of a universe little bigger than our solar system, but growing so fast a beam of light will never cross from one side to the other. After nearly 500,000 years comes the light, an incredible cosmic roar across the entire spectrum of possibilities, which soon enough settle down into the raging comfort of black holes, quasars, and galaxies. This is the age of giants, massive stars composed only of protons with just a touch of helium, which burn brightly but all too brief, then collapse, sending forth waves of hydrogen, helium, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, sodium, and magnesium, which themselves accumulate into suns so great they too burn through their resources, releasing them again as aluminum, silicon, sulfur, phosphorus, potassium, calcium, and iron. After 3 or 4 such generations in rapid succession, the remains of the old gather again to become something new. Most of the hydrogen remains and gathers through attraction to itself into a vast hot center, and the heavier elements are slowly drawn toward it. But more attracted to each other, these are caught up and collected into their own vortices, drawing down iron and silicon, sodium and oxygen, carbon and nitrogen into solid spheres of rock, hot and dry. A hurricane of comets lasting 300 million years fills the valleys, creates the oceans, and chills the air. At the boundary between water and earth, molecules come together in random arrangement, and are just as soon broken apart by the intense flow of ultraviolet light streaming from a newborn sun. Even so, these molecules live in a multitude of worlds. In the briefest of moments, when they are untouched by the sun's energy or the water's gentle embrace, they coexist across 100,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, trillion, 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 trillion other universes. Every possibility of every molecule is realized somewhere in one of those dimensions. These molecules quickly fall from that miraculous state, except in the extremely rare possibility that a molecule finds a way of maintaining the divine grace of extending its stay in the multiverse. However rare this condition may be, when multiplied across the multiverse, it becomes absolutely inevitable. One grace leads to another. The chains of molecules become longer and longer, more improbable and ever more prevalent. So life begins crossing the boundary between the improbable and the actual, sets up a wall around itself, the better to preserve its quantum housekeeping, seeking only to continue to exist. With existence, the goal now comes the first needs. It takes energy and food and whatever luck can be manufactured in the multiverse. But these are just the basics. For life is not singular, nor ever alone, but teeming from its first moments, in a multitude of forms dreamt up in the multiverse, and each is intent on continuing. Some of these forms combine, taking the best parts of each to create a new whole, while others divide, replicating wildly until the environment is overrun, forcing others to generate strategies to fight back the force of multiplication, or better, to use them as raw material for their own designs, digesting one kind of life to create another. Now some life becomes indigestible, forcing another form to endure the unendurable, reach into the multiverse for an improbability, and develop teeth for its prey, which learns to run away, then to follow, and to disguise, then to see, and so on, endlessly. Hunter chases prey, and neither can obtain nor flee from the other, the treadmill of evolution. And this, a race run by single cells. In 4 billion years of fun and games, the archaea gave way to the prokaryotes, and prokaryotes to eukaryotes, thence to the multicellular explosion of invertebrates, plants, fish, amphibians, reptiles, dinosaurs, birds, mammals, primates, and man. Are we the end of this line, or just its middle point? Of no more consequence than our distant cousins who, tiny and lemur-like, scurried about and buried themselves in earthen warrens, the better to survive the occasional and catastrophic asteroid. The smaller the better, the faster the better, the smarter the better. But smart succeeds in ways small and fast could not hope to follow. The better to eat rather than eaten, and the race is on for intelligence, memory, understanding, and self-awareness. Somewhere along this line comes another improbable grace. The train of thought speeds up immeasurably, jumps its track from genetic evolution to epigenetic transmission, first by gestures, then in babble, bubble, bicker, which begins, as with children, in objects identified, actions taken, connections made between subject and object, abstraction into classes of things, the illusions of perfect form, which ever since have deluded us, becoming crystallized in shapes etched out on ochre or molded in clay, significant for the first time because of their design, in what they communicate, even down to ourselves. Communication has become the defining characteristic of Homo sapiens. We are the species that speaks. We utter the words that create the world, have learned to take our words and translate them into the ethereal play of zeros and ones, lay them out at the speed of light, first on a wire, then on a radio wave, and lately on a beam of light, so that the voice, once constrained by mouth and ear, now straddles the entire planet in 30 millionths of a second, messages pinging back and forth, not unlike the meeting points at the synaptic gap, using photons as neurotransmitters, and each network router the equivalent of a synaptic junction, deciding whether to activate or extinguish each message that crosses the continents, connected now in a seamless, endless web of knowledge, more than 2 billion pages, more than any of us could read or know, the collected and collective intelligence of a species which seems to have made information the central mystery of culture, the project of civilization, and the goal of being. Are we in the middle of this journey, or near to the climax? It's only been 150 years since we learned that we are evolution's child, that there is a mystery, perfectly rational and impossible to fathom, which explains how we came to be. We know the beginning of the story and its end. Some 5 billion years hence, when the sun, its hydrogen stores gone, expands to fill the orbit of Jupiter, and like Kronos, eats its children. Men die, planets die, even stars die. We know all this. Because we know it, we seek something more, a transcendence of transience, translation to incorruptible form, an escape, if you will, a stop to the wheel. We seek, therefore, to bless ourselves with perfect knowledge and perfect will, to become as gods, take the universe in hand, and transform it in our own image for our own delight. As it is on earth, so it shall be in the heavens. The inevitable result of incredible improbability, the arrow of evolution is lifting us into the transhuman, an apotheosis through reason, salvation attained by good works. From the first stone hewn by the Australopithecines to flint and fire, obsidian, copper and bronze, through steam and iron and steel, the engine that drives humanity toward transhumanity is not fueled by the deeds of great men, nor the wars they fought, nor even the goods they amassed, but in the ever-increasing ability to speak the word, to talk to the hand, and make it so. The history of man, the history of all life, is that of ephemeralization, of doing more and more with less and less, of using each discovery in the material world as the springboard to the next, an ever-increasing and ever-expanding field of knowledge, an inverted pyramid built from the first hypothesis put to the test. Will this food poison me? Will it eat me? Each proven fact becoming a touchstone, necessary for all the others which rest upon it. It grows from need, the need to know becoming identical with the need to continue. But in our case, the epigenetic genesis of speech, writing, printing, telegraphy, radio, and networking has resulted in an explosion of knowledge for its own sake, a transcendence of need into the discovery of joy in the knowing. Each fact spawns its own questions, and these their own facts, and so on, until now, at the very edge of the present day, our stone knives cut single atoms. In this cutting, through endless testing, we finally found ourselves. For we are the same stuff as our tools are made of, the same atoms, raw or cooked, chaotic or orderly, and have discovered the secret bounty of evolution that lurks in every cell. Amino acids adenine, thymine, cytosine, guanine, the ones and zeros of another code, at least as old as the Earth itself, pairing up in a beauty we could not have recognized had we not already understood the power of the word to shape the world. In these chains of atoms, threading through three dimensions, we discover our past as ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. See the bacteria, invertebrate, fish, reptile, mammal, primate inside our own codes, and are just now coming to understand how these codes compute into the complex folding and binding of the proteins which are entirely what we are, the output of a program 4 billion years old and counting, moving beyond ourselves. For once the genome was transcribed, once we knew what had made us human, we had, in that moment, passed into the transhuman. Knowing our codes, we can recreate them in our so-called synthetic worlds of ones and zeros, artificial life. And now we have discovered the multiverse, where nothing is true and everything permissible. And now we will reach into the improbable, resequence ourselves into a new being, debugging the natural state, translating ourselves into supernatural, incorruptible eternals. There is no God but man. Behold Babylon the Great. Babylon is fallen. Iyoah hath accomplished his fury. He hath poured out his fierce anger and hath kindled a fire in Zion, and it hath devoured the foundations thereof. Her gates are sunk into the ground. He hath destroyed and broken her bars. How is the gold become dim? How is the most fine gold changed? The stones of the sanctuary are poured out at the top of every street. Iyoah hath swallowed up all the habitations of Jacob, and he hath not pitied. He hath thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of his daughter of Judah. He hath brought them down to the ground. He hath polluted the kingdom and the princes thereof. And now, after the war, everything, however inconsequential, has been broken down, so not even one atom sits upon another. Come and gaze upon this undifferentiated Jerusalem with ruined walls. Come and lament, not just the end of man, but the end of earth. For it is all gone, consumed in a slow fire, spread by creatures smaller than a virus, and created by the hand of man in his final act of folly. He had, in his wisdom, gained mastery of the universe, but, rich in his hatred, he then put it to the sword. So nothing now remains of the colossus that was man. Not the bones of his cities, nor even his own. Come and see, and call to mind that paragon of animals, that nearest of angels who hath fallen from grace, to come so near to heaven, and then, by his imperfections, to lose it. That is tragedy. So mourn all ye, and remember, great pride goeth before a fall. How easy we are to manipulate, how willing to believe, to follow blindly. How impossible we find it to tolerate ambiguity, to hold love and hate together in our hearts. We have not mastered the Gita, the loving battle of Krishna, nor the compassion of Buddha, nor the agape of Christ, though everything now depends upon it. The fault, dear friends, lies in our biologies, in what we are. It is said of our much maligned cousins, the Neanderthals, our nearest ancestors in the family of man, that they could focus themselves on only one task at a time, perform it with perfect intent, and move on. But we have evolved beyond them. Homo sapiens can think and be divided. We can be of two minds. Even so, our hearts, made of older stuff, remain as one, and either love or hate must do so wholly. Because we speak and can communicate in lofty and abstract terms, We can assign truth and manufacture meaning, can proselytize and demonize and stir the mind into a frenzy that the heart is sure to follow, can pen Mein Kampf or the Turner Diaries or the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, can spew hatred by wire, radio, website, knowing that someone somewhere will follow, each man in lockstep to a battle drum struck by another. Joined together, we have come to the threshold of eternity. But the echo of goose steps follow us everywhere. For our greatest strength is also our greatest weakness. And though the prophets call for it, we cannot change what we are. For this reason, Nietzsche wrote that man walks a tightrope over an abyss. On one side of the cliff, we bid farewell to our Neanderthal ancestors, to the biology of history and the glorious accident of our evolution. While on the other, we welcome our transhuman selves, angelic and perfect in will. But we, in the present moment, stare into the abyss that lies between what we were and what we would become. The abyss, Nietzsche says, stares back. Our imperfections, our attachments, our pride fill the void below us. And because we love ourselves so much as we are, we have the habit of leaping into the abyss, yearning to return to its comfortable embrace. This is the tragedy of history, repeated so often we should know it now only as farce. We are the stooges of history. And this is not a new idea. For 200 years ago, Shelley wrote, "I met a traveler from an antique land who said, 'Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on that pedestal, these words appear: My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.'" Well, I am Ozymandias, back from the dead. Come to tell you now, and I will warn you all. No empire lasts, no flesh, no clay, but all ends and goes on ending in the same tired, timeless way. If this is the way we are made, our Lucifer principle, if hell is other people, where is the forward escape or the accelerator pedal to leave behind what we are, flesh, blood, sinew, bone, which we must leave behind? Must we lose it all in order to preserve ourselves? What offerings might we lay at the altar of will and thereby make it perfect? Must we divorce from each other, create a race of autistics unable to communicate, to connect in words, thought, or hearts, each man intent only on himself, that no crowd gather nor hate destroy the common project of all? This contradictory sacrifice, a paradox of the soul, could only it be enough? Must we be angels trapped each inside his own skin, thinking private thoughts to prevent the inevitable, unthinkable destiny that awaits us? Should we dare to remain together, one race, one blood, one land? Is this the only way to become gods, each in his own private universe? It might be safe to be sure, but it will be lonely, for in the end, our only comfort is each other. History is divided into a before and an after. Before we had the capacity to annihilate ourselves, and after, when the ability will be delivered into a child's hands. In the interregnum, we balance on our tightrope, suspecting a final irony. Our triumph of the will is our greatest tragedy. And now at the end, I can be myself, neither blindly optimistic nor utterly fatalistic. Here, in this place between possibilities, the space between the heavens of the gods and the flames of hell, we can wander together through the Bardo realms, searching for a vehicle fit for our rebirth. We are being born, whether into heaven or hell, I cannot say. If this be the transhuman annunciation, we have not escaped the birth canal, nor uttered the birth cry. Yet, like human birth, the transhuman is inevitable. There is no going back, no reversal of history into the archaic, and no place to hide. In the twinkling of an eye, we will all be changed. Therein lies the terror of our situation, a terror so encompassing we have done everything, both as individuals and as a civilization, to ignore it, like an infant believing that which cannot be seen that will not be. We've cut ourselves off from the glory and the horror of the world, ignoring the incredible cornucopia of discovery, that promise of the near future, and shield our eyes from the specter of the gun held forth in a child's hand, spraying out hatred at the speed of sound. Haunted by hungry ghosts, we forget that in the Bardo, the wrathful demons chase us because they love us, because we are attached to what they represent. To move forward, we must remove our blinders, think the unthinkable, endure the unendurable. It's an essential requirement for our continued survival. We must trade the careful architecture of culture, which keeps us safe and warm, for a more. At least we can look up and see the stars. The night might be dark and cold, but at least we can look up and see the stars and any approaching asteroids. This, I believe, has been the great promise of entheogens. They open our eyes to the reality of the human condition. The psychedelic experience is an intuition of the transhuman state. They allow us, even for a few brief moments, to see beyond ourselves, to enter the transhuman. But we are imperfect. We can enter, and we always exit. We have not learned to stop the wheel of time or the cycle of karma and enter nirvana. Nor do we often return from our highs with bliss-bestowing hands like a bodhisattva. Instead, we end up back in maya, or worse, with attachments to the blissful state, the chemical paradise, which becomes its own hell. We become addicted to the lie of perpetual rising, the perfect high, the repeated solve et coagula of the soul. I can discern two exit points from the human condition which would allow us to safely pass into the transhuman. Both are technological. For technology is the expression of human will in the material world, and it is only through technology we can make our will perfect, attaining the transhuman. But these technologies differ as night from day. The first technology is ancient as the word itself, for its origins lie in the beginnings of human language. Once we moved into the epigenetic space of speech, it became possible to manipulate human beings through the transmission of ideas. In the same moment, we discovered the ineffable, that which cannot be spoken. Yet even the unspoken can be experienced directly, a Gnostic communion with the forces beyond our ken, and experience within the ineffable, even if it cannot be spoken to directly, forces an evolution of language, a linguistic interpretation of things which cannot be pronounced. For most humans, this is an unpleasant experience, perhaps because it is profoundly asocial. Language is what binds us together, and any experience which reshapes our linguistic nature separates us from our companions, forcing those who seek that experience into isolation. In the communities of the Paleolithic, archaeologists often find a single dwelling isolated from the others at the boundary between the community and the wilds of the world beyond. This is where we find the shaman, the original technologist. Even today, those cultures which have practicing shamans keep them far away from the day-to-day communities. Shamans are weird, scary, reminders of the existential terror of the ineffable, mad with God shatter, the psychological condition of ego fragmentation caused by repeated exposure to the unadulterated numinous. But if madness is the occupational disease of shamans, consider their function. They take in the raw energies of the transhuman current and step them down so that the common people can retain their connection to that which is beyond them. Shamans stand between the worlds. Like a Gnostic Janus, a shaman has one face turned toward the transhuman, while another looks upon humanity. The transhuman remains within the domain of the ineffable, even to we who are on the verge of it. If we could utter the word, we would be transhuman. Instead, we take our trips and marvel at all we see, then come back and draw or dance or make movies, trying to use all the wordless worlds of communication to return to the transhuman current and take our brothers and sisters with us. Yet as in the parable of the elephant and the blind man, we do not recognize that everything we encounter in the psychedelic experience is just one place, one mode of being, an infinitely faceted hyper-reality. But the shaman is not confused by this, nor can he be seduced by one version of the ineffable, believes in nothing he sees, or rather believes it all, without judgment, without attachment, without expectation. Thus the shaman cannot be overwhelmed or surprised or disappointed. He has thoroughly surrendered himself, and for as long as he can maintain his presence without lust of result, the shaman becomes a vehicle for transhumanity. In the typically perceptive words of Terence McKenna, a shaman is someone who has been to the end. It's someone who knows how the world really works, and knowing how the world really works means to have risen outside, above, and beyond the dimensions of ordinary space-time and casuistry, and actually seen the wiring under the board, stepped outside the confines of learned culture and learned and embedded language into the domain of what Wittgenstein called the unspeakable, the transcendental presence of the other, which can be obsectioned in various ways to yield systems of knowledge which can be brought back into ordinary social space for the good of the community. In the context of 90% of human culture, the shaman has been the agent of evolution, because the shaman learns the techniques to go between ordinary reality and the domain of the ideas, this higher dimensional continuum that is somehow parallel to us, available to us, and yet ordinarily occluded by cultural convention. And shamans are people who have been able to decondition themselves from the bewildering higher dimension and gain the mystery and go into it. Go into this bewildering higher dimension and gain knowledge. Recover the jewel lost at the beginning of time. Save souls, cure, and commune with the ancestors. It takes a lot of work and quite often a lot of drugs to become a shaman. Anyone can do it. Anyone can step across the threshold between the human and the transhuman, but not everyone survives the encounter. No one survives it completely intact. That's the nature of the experience and its price. Despite the staggering costs to our identity, this is a way to the transhuman. An ancient way which has come down to us in its more modern counterpart, witchcraft. We could, and perhaps should, become a species of shamans, unafraid of the raw possibility of the numinous. It would take courage and practice and whatever guidance we can find along the path. Luckily, we live in an era where much of the knowledge of shamans throughout the world is available to us. We need not enter into the transhuman blindly. We have 100,000 years of experience to guide us. Now, the legends of the ancient Celts tell of another people who passed into transhumanity, the Tuatha De Danann, or fairy folk as they're more commonly known, once lived upon the earth, but as humankind evolved and migrated to their lands, these people fled into the hills, somehow translating their substance into something else, creating a private universe where they were unspeakably powerful, utterly content, and endlessly happy. The human encounters with the fairy folks, and there are many of them, bear all the markings of a shamanic encounter with the numinous. Time and space are distorted, reason is confounded, and unless a person is very careful, he'll never find his way back to his companions. I wonder if the Tuatha De Danann exist, or if they're an ancient intimation of our future, or whether they'll greet us once we join them. But enough of the old science, the way of the dark. Let's fast forward 100,000 years to 1973 and consider a 10-year-old Mark Pesce reading Michael Crichton's recently published novel, The Terminal Man. This techno thriller relates the story of Harry Benson, a man with temporal lobe epilepsy, leading to seizures of thought in which he becomes uncontrollably violent. The solution to the problem? Insert electrodes into Benson's cerebral cortex, capable of delivering a counter-stimulus to ward off the seizures. Well, the operation is unsuccessful, or rather, it's too successful, because his brain learns how to generate the seizures in order to receive the pleasurable countershock. Now, Crichton's work was based on research done in the 1950s by neurophysiologist James Olds, who discovered that rats with electrodes implanted in their limbic systems, their ancient reptile brains, would sometimes ignore food and water in favor of a continuous stimulation of these electrodes up to 5,000 times an hour. And in the novel, Crichton relates the tale of a man who walks off the street into the neuropsychiatric clinic and asks for experimental and dangerous surgery just so he can experience such a continuum of pleasure. That story and the word for that man, an ELAD, electrical addict, have remained with me ever since. They form a foundation of my thinking. And although Crichton's book was touted as science fiction at the time of its publication, the science of electronic brain stimulation had already been fully explored by a Mexican neuroscientist named Jose Delgado, who used it to modify the violent behavioral traits produced by organic damage to the brain. In 1969, he wrote a popular text called Physical Control of the Mind Toward a Psycho-Civilized Society, and in it he laid out the implications of his work in absolute terms. The possibility of scientific annihilation of personal identity, or even worse, its purposeful control, has sometimes been considered a future threat even more awful than atomic holocaust. Even physicians have expressed doubt about the propriety of physical tampering with the psyche, maintaining that personal identity should be inviolable, that any attempt to modify individual behavior is unethical, and that method and related research which can influence the brain should be banned. The prospect of any degree of physical control of the mind provokes a variety of objections. Theological objections, because it affects free will. Moral objections, because it affects individual responsibility. Ethical objections, because it may block self-defense mechanisms. Philosophical objections, because it threatens personal identity. Science seems to be approaching the possibility of controlling many aspects of behavior electronically and chemically. These questions must be answered. Now, Delgado was very nearly hounded out of his field after publishing these words. No one wanted to confront the birth of the deterministic man, the cyborg, whose feelings are synthesized stimulations and who is just a mechanism of a mechanized culture. We moderns consider such thoughts profoundly dehumanizing. And although Delgado's work may seem very chilling, are his efforts qualitatively different from the world of psychotropics that have been presented by Big Pharma as the panaceas of psycho-civilization? Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Ativan, Wellbutrin, Xanax, Valium, the list grows ever longer. With each new discovery about the nature of the synaptic gap, the structure of the neuron, and the biological substrate of mind, Eric Davis and many others have written intelligently about the era of designer mind. And we can easily imagine a time when our thoughts and feelings are precisely tuned by our healthcare professionals, the era of better living through neurochemistry. Yet there's an even simpler and likely more effective mechanism to make us all happy, or at least complacent. The work of Dr. Michael Persinger of Laurentian University in Quebec has been widely reported in the media over the last few years because of his discovery of the God module, an area of the brain associated with sensations of divine presence and mystical experience. Dr. Persinger has even perfected an apparatus which externally stimulates this region of the brain using electromagnetic waves and a focused beam. But before his work became widely known, Dr. Persinger authored a paper titled, and it's, I quote, "On the possibility of directly accessing every human brain by electromagnetic induction of fundamental algorithms." Here's what he says in the abstract. "Contemporary neuroscience suggests the existence of fundamental algorithms by which all sensory transduction is translated into the intrinsic brain-specific code. Direct stimulation of these codes within the human temporal or limbic cortices by applied electromagnetic patterns may require energy levels that are within the reach of both geomagnetic activity and contemporary communication networks. A process which is coupled to the narrow band of brain temperature could allow all normal human brains to be affected." Given what we already know about the brain and how electromagnetic fields can shape the way we feel, Dr. Persinger believes that a global mechanism could be constructed which would effectively create the same feeling in all of us, everywhere, simultaneously. Well, with chilling and scientifically supportable statements like these, you could well begin to wonder if the oft-expressed paranoid delusion of mind control satellites isn't simply a prehension of the future, rather than an unrealistic flight from reality. And perhaps we should all begin wearing tinfoil helmets. And now, I must ask the inevitable question. Are we just machines, ready to be programmed into new states of being. I recall my favorite line from another film about mind control, Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange. When a man ceases to choose, he ceases to be a man. This is true as anything that's ever been said about man. But we're not talking about man anymore. We're speaking of transhumanity. The gun is the archetype of violence in our world. It is all of human evil cast into a single object. And the question it asks of each of us is this: can we choose not to pull the trigger, no matter what the situation, even in our own defense? As long as we do not know the answer to that question, we will inevitably fail at the threshold of the transhuman. For our own hatred, the hatred of even just one of us, will consume all of us and the entire earth. The safest course, it would seem, would be to deny ourselves the capacity to act by ridding ourselves of the emotions that would drive us toward the act. So here then are the two possibilities. Both are madness. Life is not singular nor ever objective. Nietzsche noted that the forms of a new culture are always seen as demonic by the culture which precedes it. We're getting into regions beyond good and evil. Any of the rules we know of do not apply. Would that we could travel to the place beyond words, the ineffable, where we could sit in knowing silence, accepting the terror and understanding it. But words are all we have, and they're all I can offer you. We know this: history has failed us, or rather left us with no clear path toward the transhuman. Yet it comes just the same, and no solution lies within easy reach. So now we have to ask ourselves, do we want to straddle the doorway and suffer the blindness of unbearable light? Or should we build mind control satellites, now that this capability is within our grasp, stimulating our brains into a constant gnosis, a simulation of God? Which path to the angels? when we've gone beyond reason and logic and goodwill and accepted the horror of the situation, the terror of the terminus, when we can look at it without flinching, without sorrow, without pity, neither trusting the lie of perpetual rising nor the rumors of apocalyptic demise, without cyborgs or demons, angels or eschaton, but if it is just us, only us together, in the place where words cannot reach, what then is there that divides you from me, I and thou? In my very clearest and highest moments, my ego subdued or inflated beyond all bounds, being much the same thing, in those moments when the universe accepts me into her bosom, or rather, I accept her embrace, when this is that and that this, a condition of utter simplicity, costing not less than everything. Yet I will not be swept up in a false nirvana, nor in mindlessness, nor in hatred, nor in sweet dreams of tomorrow's promise, nor in the darkening gentle of another good night. For now I lay me down to sleep, and dreams come in which I must awaken.